If a pupil on probation does something unusually good, for the moment the master flashes a little more attention on him, and may even send a wave of encouragement of some sort, or he may put some work in the pupil's way, and see how he does it. Generally, however, he delegates that to some of his senior pupils. Thus the link between the pupil and his master is chiefly one of observation, and perhaps occasional use of the pupil. It is not the custom of the adepts to employ special or sensational tests. The pupil is usually left to follow the ordinary course of his life, the living image affording sufficient indication of his character and progress. The average time for probation is said to be 7 years, but it may be indefinitely lengthened, or on the other hand it may be very much shortened. It has been known to extend for 30 years, and it has been known to be reduced to a few weeks. On the probationary path, the man's highest consciousness works upon the higher mental plane. When a pupil is accepted, he is taken into his master's consciousness to so great an extent that whatever he sees or hears is within the knowledge of his master. Not that the master sees or hears it at the same moment, though that often happens, but that it lies within the master's memory, exactly as it lies within the memory of the pupil, so that he could recollect it at any time that he chose to do so. Whatever the pupil feels or thinks is thus within the astral and mental bodies of his master. The master in this way blends the aura of the pupil with his own, so that his forces may be constantly acting, without special attention on his part, through the pupil. It must not be thought that a mere unconscious channel is required. On the contrary, the pupil must become a keenly intelligent cooperator. If, unfortunately, it should happen that there comes into the mind of the pupil some thought which is not fit to be harbored by the master, as soon as he feels it, he at once erects a barrier, and shuts off from himself that vibration. To do this, of course, diverts his attention for a moment from his other work, and takes a certain amount of energy. The union between the pupil and the master, that begins with acceptance, is permanent, so that the higher vehicles of the pupil are always vibrating in common with those of his master. The whole time he is being tuned up, thus growing more and more like the master. At all times the thoughts of the pupil are largely preoccupied with thoughts of his master and his influence, so that, while he is sensitively open to him, he is to a considerable extent closed to lower influences. It is not, however, expected that a pupil shall be actively thinking of nothing else but his master, but it is expected that the form of the master shall always be in the background of his mind, always within the immediate reach, always there when needed in the vicissitudes of life. Whilst reasonable relaxation and change of thought are necessary to mental health, the pupil should, of course, be scrupulously careful to permit no thought, even for a moment, which he would be ashamed for his master to see. The process of attuning can take place only slowly. A living being is being molded, and it is essential that the slow growth from within should adapt the form to the outside influence, much as a gardener gradually directs the limbs of a tree. Although the master is working upon thousands of people simultaneously, as well as doing other and much higher work, yet the effect is as though he were watching the pupil and thinking of no one else. For the attention that he can give to one among hundreds is greater than ours when we concentrate it entirely upon one. The master often leaves to some of his older pupils the work of tuning the lower bodies, though he himself is allowing a constant flow between his vehicles and those of the pupil. It is in this way that he does most for his pupils, without their necessarily knowing anything about it. The accepted pupil thus becomes an outpost of the master's consciousness, so that whatever is done in his presence is done in the master's presence. Although the master may be unconscious of such events at the time when they happen, nevertheless they are, as said, in his memory afterwards. The experiences of the pupil are thus in the master's mind among his own knowledge, as soon as he turns his attention to the subject concerned. Even purely physical things, such as a slight shock or noise, in the consciousness of the pupil, are also in the consciousness of the master. A wise pupil, therefore, tries to avoid any kind of shock, and for that reason he is usually a gentle and quiet sort of person. A pupil is always connected with his master by a constant current of thought and influence, which expresses itself on the mental plane as a great ray or stream of dazzling light of all colors, violet and gold and blue. When, however, the pupil sends a thought of devotion to his master, the result is a sudden intensification of the colors of this bar of light, and a distinct flow of spiritual influence from the master towards the pupil. The reason for this is that the master's power is flowing outwards always and in all directions like the sunlight. The touch of the pupil's thought vivifies his connection with the master and simply gives a wider opening through which the great ocean of the master's love can find vent. So intimate is the union between the consciousness of the pupil and his master that, as mentioned in chapter 11, the pupil can at any time see what his master's thought is upon any given subject, and in that way often save himself from error. This privilege must not be misused. It is a power of ultimate reference in questions of great difficulty. It is not intended that the pupil should save himself the trouble of thinking, or of deciding ordinary matters which he is quite competent to determine for himself. In a similar manner, at a higher level, the initiate may place his thought beside that of the brotherhood, and draw into himself just as much of that tremendous consciousness as he, at his level, is able to respond to. The initiate, similarly, must strive never to introduce anything discordant into that mighty consciousness, which is acting as a whole. We may repeat here what was said in chapter 11, viz., that the master can at any moment send a thought through the pupil, either in the form of a suggestion or a message. For example, when the pupil is writing a letter or delivering a lecture. In earlier stages the pupil is often unconscious of this, but he very soon learns to recognize the thought of the master. In fact, it is eminently necessary that he should learn to recognize it, because there are many other entities on the astral and mental planes who may make similar suggestions, and it is well that the pupil should learn to distinguish from whom they came. The use by a master of his pupil's body is entirely different from what is ordinarily understood by mediumship. The mechanism and rationale of mediumship has already been explained in the etheric double and the astral body, together with the objections to it. To the use by a master of a pupil's body there can, of course, be no objections. The influence of a master is so powerful that it may well shine through to almost any extent, and a sensitive person might be conscious of his presence even to the extent of seeing his features or hearing his voice instead of those of the pupil. It is improbable that there will be any purely physical change, though this of course frequently happens in mediumship. Neither is the relationship between master and pupil in any way one of coercion, or one in which the pupil's individuality is submerged in the flood of power from the master. On the contrary, the master's influence is not a hypnotic force from without, but an inexpressibly wonderful illumination from within, irresistible because so deeply felt as in perfect accord with the pupil's highest aspiration, and as the self-revelation of his own spiritual nature. The master being himself in fullest measure a channel of the divine life, that which flows from him awakens into activity the seed of divinity within the pupil. The process is somewhat analogous to that of electrical induction. It is because of the identity of nature in the two that the influence of the master stimulates in the highest degree all the noblest and highest qualities in the pupil. The love of the master for a disciple may be likened to the sunshine which opens the lotus bud to the morning air. It may in truth be said that one smile from the master will call forth from the pupil such an outburst of affection as would be gained only by months of scholastic meditation on the virtue of love. From the above it is clear that any disturbance in the lower bodies of the pupil will affect also those of the master. Should such disturbance occur, the master drops a veil that shuts the pupil off from himself, lest there be interference with his own work. Such an unfortunate incident does not usually last longer than 48 hours, but in extreme, and very rare, cases, it may endure for years, or even for the remainder of that incarnation. Practically all ordinary people turn their forces inward upon themselves, and thus become a jangling mass of self-centered forces. One who would become an accepted pupil must learn to turn himself outwards, concentrating his attention and strength upon others, pouring out helpful thoughts and good wishes upon his fellow men. Thus the disciple, and even the aspirant for discipleship, is taught to hold all powers entirely for the service of the world. The sharing by the lower consciousness of the knowledge of the higher is determined mainly by the needs of the work that is being done. Whilst it is necessary that the disciple should have the full use of his vehicles on the higher planes, the conveyance of a knowledge of that work to the physical body, which is in no way concerned with it, is usually a matter of no importance. The strain upon the physical body, when the higher consciousness compels it to vibrate responsively, is very great, at the present stage of evolution, and unless external circumstances are very favorable, this strain is apt to cause nervous disturbance and hypersensitiveness, with its attendant evils. Hence, most of those whose high vehicles are developed, and whose most important work is done out of the physical body, remain apart from the busy haunts of men, thus preserving the sensitive physical body from the rough usage and clamor of ordinary life. Furthermore, as soon as a pupil shows any signs of psychic faculty, full instructions are always given to him as to the limitations which are placed on its use. Briefly, these restrictions are that such faculty shall not be used, 1. To satisfy mere curiosity, 2. For selfish purposes, 3. In order to display phenomena. That is to say, the same considerations which govern the actions of a man of right feeling on the physical plane are expected to apply also on the astral and mental planes. The pupil is never under any circumstances to use his additional power to promote his own worldly advantage, or in connection with gain in any way, and he is never to give what is called in spiritualistic circles a test, that is, any indisputable physical plane proof of abnormal power. There is always a gentle radiation of the master's influence flowing through the pupil, even though the pupil be not conscious of it. At certain times the pupil may feel a greatly increased flow of force, although he may not know where it is going. With a little careful attention he can learn in which direction it is going, and a little later he can follow it more definitely with his consciousness and trace it to the actual people who are being affected by it. The pupil, however, cannot direct it, being simply a channel. Later, the master may tell the pupil to seek out a person and give him some of the force. As the pupil increases in usefulness, more and more of the work is placed in his hands, thus relieving, even only in small degree, the strain upon the master. Occasionally a pupil may even be given a definite message to deliver to a particular person. It is possible to obtain constant contact with the master in another way. Just as images of persons made by a man in devachan are filled with life by the egos of the persons concerned, so the master fills with his real presence the thought form produced by his pupil. Through that form real inspiration and sometimes instruction may be given. An example of this was that of a Hindu yogi in the Madras Presidency, who claimed to be a pupil of the master Maurya. Having met his master physically and become his pupil, the yogi claimed that he did not lose his master after he went away, for he used frequently to appear to him and instruct him through a center within himself. There is yet a third stage of even more intimate union, when a pupil becomes the son of the master. The link is such that not only the lower mind, but also the ego in the causal body of the pupil, is enfolded within that of the master. The master can then no longer draw a veil to cut off the pupil, so as to separate the consciousness even for a moment. An accepted pupil has the right, and the duty, to bless in the name of the master, and a splendid outpouring of the master's power will assuredly follow his effort to do so. The son of the master can give the very touch of the master's intimate presence. He who is a son of the master either is or soon will be a member of the Great White Brotherhood also, that, of course, confers the power of blessing in the name of the Brotherhood. In the greater mysteries, celebrated principally at Eleusis, the initiates were named Epoptai, that is those whose eyes were opened. Their emblem was the golden fleece of Jason, the symbol of the mental body. The pupil was shown the effect in the heaven world of a certain line of life, study and aspiration on earth. He was also taught the whole history of the evolution of the world and of man, in its deeper aspect. The pupil further received not only teachings about the conditions of the mental plane, but also instruction as to the development of the mental body as a vehicle. Freemasons will be interested to note that an ear of corn was shown to the aspirant as symbolical of the supreme mystery at Eleusis, and is probably connected with the fact that a sheaf of corn is often carved on the chair of the SW in a Masonic lodge. When a man is initiated, The influence to which he has tuned himself on higher planes rushes through every part of his being. Though there is little effect in the solids, liquids, and gases of the physical plane, there is a great deal of radiation from the etheric double, and from his astral and mental bodies, and this is felt both by the kingdom of nature, and by such men as are in a condition to respond. A very great expansion and development of the mental body takes place in connection with the second initiation, but it is usually some years before the effects can show themselves in the physical brain. They unquestionably put a great strain on the brain, as it cannot be instantaneously tuned to the necessary pitch. The period after the second initiation is in many ways the most dangerous anywhere on the path, the danger in nearly all cases coming through pride. When a man gets a glimpse of what his intellect will be in the future, he must guard against and kill out every trace of pride, selfishness and prejudice. This danger point in the life on the initiate is indicated in the gospel story by the temptation in the wilderness, which followed the baptism of Christ by John. The 40 days in the wilderness symbolize the period during which the expansion of the mental body is being worked down into the physical brain, though for the ordinary candidate some 40 years might well be required for its accomplishment. The eye-making faculty, the Ahamkara, cp. 266, which is generally described as mana, pride, since pride is the subtlest manifestation of the eye as distinct from others, is the last fetter of separateness which the Arhat casts off before he takes the fifth initiation and becomes a master, an Asekha. Ahamkara was born with the soul, is the essence of individuality, and persists till all that is valuable in it is worked into the monad. It is finally dropped on the threshold of liberation. In that survival of the ancient mysteries known as Freemasonry, the EA corresponds to the stage of the probationary pupil, and is required to practice the three qualities of discrimination, desirelessness, and good conduct or self-control, Vivka, Virajya and Shatsampati. Discrimination will give him mental power, desirelessness emotional power, self-control will power. Discrimination enables the candidate to pass unscathed through the lower regions of the astral world, represented in co-masonry, in the first symbolical journey. Desirelessness enables him to pass through the alliance of the high astral world, represented in the second symbolical journey. Good conduct will enable him to master the highest part of the astral world, on the very borders of the heaven world, represented in the third symbolical journey. The G of the first degree indicates the necessity of conquering the desire nature. The general effect of the first degree is to widen somewhat the channel of connection between the ego and the personality of the candidate. The master color of the first degree is crimson. The EA in Freemasonry corresponds to the subdeacon in the Christian Church. The P. G. between the first and the second degree indicates the necessity of conquering the peculiar entanglement of the lower mind in the meshes of desire which we know as karma manas. In the second degree, the idea of illumination is put before the candidate, the special object being the development of the intellectual, artistic and psychic faculties, and the control of the lower mind. The effect of the degree is a more decided widening of the link between the ego and the personality. The G of the second degree indicates the need of full control of the lower mind. The master color of the second degree is yellow. The FC in Freemasonry corresponds to the order of deacon in the Christian Church, for just as the F.C is preparing himself for the work of the MM, so is the deacon preparing himself for the work of the priesthood. The PG between the second and the third degree indicates the necessity of gaining some mastery over the strange intermediate tract beyond the lower mind, which in a certain school of thought is denominated the subliminal consciousness. In the third degree, the work is principally on the higher mental plane. The predominant color is a blue tinge. The MM corresponds to the priest in the church. In the first degree, the Ida, or feminine aspect of the etheric force, is stimulated, thus making it easier for the man to control passion and emotion. The Ida starts from the base of the spine on the left of a man, and the right of a woman, and ends in the medulla oblongata. It is crimson in color. In the second degree, the Pingala or masculine aspect of the force is strengthened, thus facilitating the control of mind. Pingala starts from the base of the spine on the right of a man, and the left of a woman, ending in the medulla oblongata. It is yellow in color. In the third degree, the sushumna, the central energy itself, is aroused, thus opening the way for the influence of the pure spirit from on high. It is deep blue in color. The EA, as a personality, should organize his physical life for higher use. As an ego, he should be developing active intelligence in his causal body. For this he must use his will, the first person of the Trinity, the power of Shiva, to employ the Hindu terminology, reflected by his outward turned power, or Shakti, Devigiriya or Parvati, who gives self-control, and who blesses the physical body and makes its powers holy. The FC, as a personality, is organizing his emotional life. As an ego, he is unfolding intuitional love in his buddhic body. This he does with the power of the second person of the Trinity, the love that comes from Vishnu, through Lakshmi, who fulfills desires and makes life rich and full, sanctifying material prosperity and transmuting the passions of the astral body. The MM, as a personality, is arranging his mental life. As an ego, he is strengthening his spiritual will Atma. To conquer the wavering mind, he must use the power of thought, or Kriya Shakti, the divine activity of the third person of the Trinity, Brahmi, reflected by Saraswati, the patroness of learning and practical wisdom. At the same time, the EA should also be learning to control his emotions, the FC should be mastering his mind, and the MM should be developing on higher planes. Chapter 34 Conclusion. Few words are necessary in bringing to a close this study of man's mental body and the lower mental plane. It may, however, be useful to look back over the ground we have covered and endeavor to obtain a perspective view of the relative importance and significance of our subject matter, its setting amongst the totality of our knowledge of modern theosophy. The student cannot help being struck by the great difference between the atmosphere of the mental world and that of the astral world, let alone that of the physical. By comparison with the mental world, the astral world is heavy, crude, turgid, and unsatisfying, even at its loftiest levels. However pure and refined the state of feeling to which it may raise us, we feel that we are still far from our true home. The dignity of man's soul demands more than feeling, however pure and unselfish. The mental plane, even its four lower levels, conveys the impression that we are distinctly nearer home. Here there is more of freedom, we feel that we are more the masters of our own consciousness, less the servants of our vehicles. The mental world seems a cleaner and more wholesome world, where we can shape our destiny nearer to our will than seems possible in the worlds we have left below us. Consciousness is freer to roam where it will, far less restricted by the limitations of space and time. Nevertheless, mastery of even the lower mental world, of the totality of concrete thinking, leaves us still unsatisfied, for through it and beyond it we can plainly sense that there are yet fresh and greater worlds to conquer. This world of concrete thought is as far as we can go while we still belong to the lower planes. To plant our feet firmly on this thought world, and reach upwards to the very abstractions of thought, is surely will bring us to the threshold of a world higher and purer, not only in degree, but in kind, than any of the lower worlds. Through those abstractions we shall rise to the world of the spirit, and draw appreciably nearer to the God consciousness from which we feel and know ourselves to be temporarily exiled. But we must not minimize the vast importance of the lower mental world, especially at the present juncture in man's psychological history. Let us, therefore, recapitulate in briefest form the outstanding features which emphasize the importance of mind, and of the mental world, to men in their evolution. In the scheme of seven chains, to which we belong, every chain has globes on the lower mental plane, while six of the seven chains have also globes on the higher mental plane. Of the 49 globes in all, 24, or practically half, are on the mental plane. The following diagrams sets out these facts clearly, the mental globes, being blacked in solid, in order to emphasize the points mentioned. The habitat of the ego, the thinker, the one who endures throughout all reincarnations, is on the higher mental plane. The mental plane is the meeting ground between the higher and the lower selves. The ray, which the higher or divine part of man projects into the lower worlds in order to carry out the purposes of evolution, is a ray of lower mind, emerging from the higher mind. The battleground of life today, for most men, is karma manas, the intermingling of mind with desire. The consciousness of most men today is centered in their feelings, in the astral body. Hence, the next immediate step for them is to learn to master feelings, to control the astral body, and this, as we have seen, can be achieved only from the plane above. From the mind, the next step will be to raise the center of consciousness from the astral to the mental world. The very name man means the thinker, the being possessing mind. Man, in occultism, has been defined as that being in the universe, in whatever part of the universe he may be, in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are joined together by intelligence. The development of mind in man has been expedited a whole round by the influence of the Lords of the Flame. In the next round, the fifth, the progress to be made in mental development must clearly be prodigious, and, to our limited minds as at present developed, in the nature of things inconceivably lofty. These few considerations, it is submitted, constitute a formidable array, and scarcely call for further comment. They are their own emphasis of a crucial importance to man, at his present stage, of the mind and the mental body, not indeed as a final achievement, but as a necessary stepping stone to that future of man which, in the words of the Master, is the future of a thing whose growth and splendor have no limit. Nevertheless, whilst emphasizing one aspect of our work, and that an aspect unquestionably of great importance, it is necessary to preserve a careful sense of proportion and balance, giving to each element its due weight, and no more. Hence, as Annie Besant, and C.W. Leadbeater have written, so far as the Theosophical Society is concerned, its great object is not so much to provide mental development as to raise those who are ready into responsiveness to Buddhic influences, to reawaken the sensitiveness of its members on a higher turn of the spiral, and to prepare them for the new race, now starting on its way in the world. The society does not deprecate mental development, far from it, but it prepares for the next stage, when intuitional love will produce harmony and brotherhood, and will employ the developed intellect to build a new civilization, based on those ideals. Chapter 1 General Description. Every student of occultism is familiar with the fact that man possesses several bodies or vehicles through which he is enabled to express himself on the various planes of nature, physical, astral, mental, and so forth. The occultist finds that physical matter exists in seven grades or orders of density, viz., atomic, subatomic, superetheric, etheric, gaseous, liquid, solid. Particles of all these grades enter into the composition of the physical vehicle. The latter, however, has two well-marked divisions, viz., the dense body, composed of solids, liquids and gases, and the etheric body, or double, as it is frequently called, consisting of the four finer grades of physical matter. It will be our purpose in these chapters to study this etheric double, its nature, appearance, functions, its relationships to the other vehicles, its connection with prana, or vitality, its birth, growth and decay, its connection with certain methods of healing, with mesmerism, with mediumship and materializations, the powers it can be made to exercise, and a host of miscellaneous etheric phenomena with which it is connected. Briefly, we shall find that the etheric double, while necessary to the life of the physical body, is not, properly speaking, a separate vehicle of consciousness, that it receives and distributes the vital force which emanates from the sun and is thus intimately connected with physical health, that it possesses certain chakrams or force centers of its own, each with its distinct function, that upon the action of etheric matter mainly depends the memory of the dream life, that it plays an important part in determining the kind of physical vehicle which an incarnating ego will receive, that, like the physical body, it dies and decays in due course, releasing the soul for the next stage in its cyclic journey, that it is especially associated with what is known as vital or magnetic healing, and also with mesmerism, whether for purposes of healing, anesthesia, or trance, that it is the principal factor concerned in seance room phenomena, such as the movement of objects, production of raps and other sounds,